Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. This is Eric Loomis, and I am very happy to be here today with Nate Holdren, who is in the Law, Politics, and Society Department at Drake University. And we're here to talk about his prize-winning book, and deservedly so, Injury Impoverished, Workplace Accidents, Capitalism, and Law in the Progressive Era, which was published by Cambridge University Press in 2020. It also won the Philip Taft Award for Best Book in Labor History and was runner-up for the Organization of American Historians Merle Curdy Prize for Best Book Published in U.S. Intellectual History. So it's prize-winning, again, for a reason. I'm really excited for this. And Nate, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Would you start by talking about the book and why you decided to write on this topic?
Yeah. So I always make a joke about it. There's a shorthand. Things used to be really bad and worse than you think, but then later they were differently bad and worse than you think. That's kind of the vibe. So the book is about employee injury in the early 20th century and injury law, specifically the origins and early operations of workers' comp laws. And I think the interpretive point of view that the book tries to take is to say, like, if you think of an injured worker and give that person a real hard look in the face, you know, like, and then look at how institutions respond to their injuries and how those things relate. And so it's really a book that's meant to kind of call attention to the real humanity of people who get hurt on a regular basis in the economy, and then to have that humanity inform a kind of sensibility of looking for the ways things fall short. I did not plan to work on this stuff. I set out to be a women's and gender historian who was going to write about working class women. And I found some lawsuits, and I was going to do a kind of common social history, labor historian thing of legal documents provide a window into someone's life. And so I was reading these lawsuits for information about what it was like to be a woman in an industrial workplace. And it took me a really long time to realize this is kind of laughable now because I teach in a legal studies department, but you don't go to court and just tell your life story. You go to court as an interested legal actor. And so then I was like, oh, wait a minute, the law is really important. And so then I was thinking a lot about the law, and I was going to write about ideas of gender in the law prior to 1910, because workers' comp laws start coming in 1910. And I had these lawsuits that I found really compelling. And then I was working on that project, and I was in Madison, Wisconsin at the Wisconsin State Historical Society. I actually was there right when everything kicked off, the protests around Scott Walker's budget bill. I just happened to be there randomly. It was funny the way research can take us into contemporary life. I was there for that, and I was looking for women industrial workers prior to 1910, and there were two boxes of materials from the Wisconsin Industrial Commission that the commission had given to the Historical Society and had given little key numbers. There were tons of folders in it with their own number. And then at some point the index had been lost. And so it had been organized topically, and then the list of topics was lost. And so it was just a completely random material. So I read everything in both boxes, and I'm really lucky the index was lost, because then I found evidence of disabled men having their employment threatened in the 30s as a result of workers' comp laws. I was like, huh, that doesn't make sense. Oh, well, it's not about women. It's 20 years later. That'll make a good footnote in the conclusion to the project. And then the more and more I was thinking about it, I just kind of couldn't stop thinking about that. It was really compelling. And that I wanted to explain that. And so the whole process became, how do I get from these women industrial workers in like 1905 losing hands in industrial laundries to disabled people losing their jobs in the 30s. And since then, Sarah Rose has written a great book called No Right to Be Idle that covers some overlap with my stuff. And had it come out earlier, I probably wouldn't have written my stuff, but at the time it wasn't out. It was just detective work. How did we get from 1905 to 1931? And also, like, you know, did I find the one example of a disabled guy losing his job, or were there more? And so for a long time, I just was digging to see what in fact happened. And then as I got to writing, that was the dissertation. It was just kind of institutional detective story. And then with the writing the book, you know, I got to the end of the dissertation and I was like, there aren't really any people in here. There's some stuff on economists and markets and insurance and policy. But I'm the first person in my family to go to college. My family, my extended family are all in construction. A lot of people in so high injury kind of jobs. And every member of my family growing up had been hurt in work. Like my mom got hurt at UPS and I kind of like hit me and I was like, you know, that wasn't why I wrote this stuff. But it was like, oh, you know, none of the humanity is in here. So then when I was really writing the book, the move from dissertation to book was like interpretive and being like, you know, this should make us uneasy. Like this should not be a palatable thing to sit with. And the dissertation I think it was good, but it was much more palatable of a read, I think, in the dissertation. And the book was kind of being like, you know, reading about someone who loses their fingers should be really unsettling. And then I was also teaching in this legal studies department and thinking a lot about, what the law does, and like the law represents these injuries in ways that are kind of boring, actually, you know, and like the idea that people suffer these terrible tragedies and then that's depicted in a boring way is notable. So
well talk more about that. Like, you know, I think you're right, it is represented in, you know, in this, as you put it, boring way, but the fact that it's in this boring way, right, that does work in its own right for, in many cases, the companies, right? So how are these things represented? Why is it boring, and why does that matter?
Yeah, that's a great point. So this is something that I would like, so this is like, sort of, this is, I'm an empiricist, and you know, there's a lot of theory in the book of mine, but I really am an empiricist. And so I can't prove the reception, but you know, people get hurt and it shows up in dollar amounts. People die and it's a cost. And so what businesses get are kind of, you know, the decision makers in businesses, what they get are dollar amounts and liabilities. And there's this sort of framing of like, you know, you don't want to pay extra money, do you? And like someone who's next to like the physical, like in the labor process, someone sees their coworker get hurt, or a foreman or a supervisor sees the person right under them get hurt, they have all these experiences, but those experiences are not institutionally relevant. They fall out of the decision-making process. You know, so like the fact that the coworkers and foremen are traumatized, like nobody's happy about that, but businesses are not making choices about like, hey, let's avoid the experience of trauma. Let's have that horrible experience for the family. Let's steer by that. They steer by dollar amounts and numbers, and the law traffics in those dollar amounts and numbers. And I think that's not unique to injury. I mean, like, you know, when a business fires someone, that has tremendous ramifications, right? When I'm at an institution with a lot of turnover, we're not paid very well, and people leave every year. And that's lonely for those of us who are sticking here long-term, and everyone involved, people at the top feel sad about it, but those are not institutionally relevant facts. And so I think that's kind of one of the things I tried to do in the interpretive part of the book is like, let's talk about injury really seriously, but I wanted the analysis to have some legs about like, there's this disconnect between our lived humanity and our values, and then the institutional decision-making processes. And you can, I think that goes all the way to the top. I think there's very few people at the top of the food chain who are happy with the negative outcomes that we in labor history, you know, like to gripe about, but they're not able to make that unhappiness, like that doesn't matter. Like they're privately unhappy, but you know, so what? That's not institutionally relevant. You can't pull a lever that says, hey, let's get rid of the unhappiness, because the machinery is just kind of required to operate based on incentives and in a policy environment.
Well, I mean, I guess how do we get to that point, right? In other words, you know, the way that you describe this process, right, is that you have these initial court decisions in the 19th century, such as the Farwell case, that, you know, basically put all the onus on workers. And then you have these lawsuits come in, and the lawsuits grow and grow, right? And there's more and more of them. And so business begins to try to rationalize this through workers' comp. I mean, am I basically describing that more or less correctly in two sentences?
Absolutely. So work's super dangerous. It was back then, it is now still. And there's more and more study of the problem of injury. So working class people are aware of danger, but what working class people know is only sometimes institutionally relevant. And so there's this growing awareness kind of outside of the working class population of how dangerous work is. And so there's like the Knights of Labor fight for the founding of state bureaus of labor statistics. And so there's all this effort to say, let's understand this. And we saw like a contemporary analog of this, of Matthew Desmond wrote that book Evicted a few years ago, and he won big prizes, and it's a good book. And what he's basically doing is saying, taking things that working class people know about eviction and capturing it for a larger audience. And so there's moves like that of saying, let's make this problem represented to broader society. And there's a whole bunch of efforts around that. And that tends to lead to various policy innovations to say, let's address this. And so one of the things that happens is there's policies that are made that make it easier to sue for injured workers. But they still leave a lot of workers high and dry. But what it does is it raises costs to businesses. And after a while, those costs start spiraling. And so then there becomes a consensus of we need to control all these costs. And that's where we get workers' comp. It's really a cost control legislation. And, you know, progressives at the time, in the our sense, people on the left are like, well, this will direct more money to working class hands. And so that's what we want, which is good. But the real impetus behind it is like solving problems for power for people.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's to me, you know, I've written about this stuff, not in nearly the detail you have, but when I write a book on the timber industry, which is of course tremendously dangerous, you know, yeah, I try to do some of what you do in terms of describing injury and trying to make that real for people and talking about the details of this. And, you know, I think this is when I first really began to realize, and, you know, of course this is several years ago now, but that, you know, workers' comp ultimately was a pro-business set of legislation, and that, you know, I think that it matters when we think about what is a limited social welfare state in America, particularly concerning the job, how much of it, even what the crumbs that we get are actually designed to protect business more than they are to protect workers.
Absolutely. And, you know, as people who live off those crumbs, of course, we want them to be as large as possible. And if we can, you know, people who can work in that overlap between the relative interests of the powerful and the interests of the rest of us to make those crumbs bigger. I mean, I'm glad to get bigger crumbs, but I think, you know, that is kind of the, what I try to do in the book. I think it's one of the things that labor historians try to do generally, of being like sort of noting that pattern of like, hey, you know, they get a whole loaf and we get some crumbs, and like, we need to fight for bigger crumbs, but also just sort of continuing to note that I think there's a tension there of like, we want, of course, as humanitarians, we want people to have better lives. Absolutely. And then also continuing to and to celebrate the victories, but then also continuing to note the kind of fundamental unfairness of like, even though we got bigger crumbs, like the loaf also got bigger and they continue to get more. And, you know, these are not things that I could exhaust in the book, but I tried to write the book kind of ambitiously. I tried to be interpretively ambitious that I wanted the book to kind of equip people to raise these questions in other contexts. And hope to, you know, this is partly again teaching in a you know, legal studies program. I want to be able to teach my book to my students and be like, here's ways you can think about the law. Cause I didn't land in a history department. So, but,
well, you know, I recently, reviewed a book, called On the Job, which is about worker centers in mostly in Texas. And, I think the New Press published it. And, you know, in some ways it did quite a bit of some of the sort of things that you're doing, except in you know, contemporary times, which is that you have just these tremendously dangerous workplaces in which people are dying pretty frequently. And, you know, it's this sort of like, how do we put a name to these people? And then what kind of, you know, actions can we take to actually protect people at the workforce, right? And that, you know, I think that you point out in the conclusion that something like 5,000 workers die each year in America. Is that correct?
Yeah. So from about 2000 to present, it's, you know, it fluctuates a little bit, but it's basically 5,000 a year, and it's bigger in the 80s and 90s. So work remains incredibly dangerous, and, you know, it'll be bigger now under COVID because there's a lot, though, you know, there's a lot of politicking in this too. This is sort of in the backdrop of what I wanted the book to do, is like kind of raise questions. Like, I say like a lot of workers die, but, you know, like, what's a large pile of corpses? You know, like, what's a small stack of corpses? And there's like this pressure for us to think about the number of dead workers as a small number of dead workers. And like, for me, and I think for those of us who do labor history, that's a contradiction in terms. Like one dead worker is a lot of dead workers. But I've had people say to me many times where they're like, well, you know, five, of course it's unfortunate, but you know, 5,000 workers, there's 300 million Americans. And I just, you know, and part of it's my class background and part of it is doing labor history. It's like the people who say that to me do not think of themselves as an us that includes those 5,000 dead people. They're like, 5,000 of those people over there is of course unfortunate, but it feels small. And that's also, I think, something that I think is important for us, you know, people in our, you know, the cloth that you and I are cut from as labor historians, to be like, you know, let's just note here that the harms on the working class are political harms, and are, and it's a lot of harm. You know, there's no, I think we're encouraged to see harms as small as part of finding them acceptable.
Well, I agree. And I think that another piece, and we're getting a little bit away from your book, I guess, right now, but another way I think in which this is, these numbers are sort of swept under the rug, is I think that a lot of the decline in workplace injury came from so much dangerous work being outsourced. And so, you know, I mean, I would be, it would be really interesting. And I don't know that statistically you could do this, but to compare the number of workers who were dying making products for Americans, has it actually gone down? Right. You know, from 100 years ago, or is, you know, the steel that's being made in China and the, you know, the textiles in Bangladesh, are is the actual number of dead workers the same or even higher than it was 100 years ago?
That is a great point. You know, I'm embarrassingly typical U.S. historian that I mostly know about what's in the U.S., but I did look this up once, you know, just one data point. Hope maybe one of your listeners can go on and solve it. The International Labor Organization, I don't remember the year, sometime in the 21st century, in the early 2000s, their estimate at the time was that 5,000 workers every day die somewhere in the global economy. And I'm from a town of about 2,500 people. So like my town disappears twice a day, basically, in the global economy. And that's a really fascinating point that you raised about that it maybe there's not actually a decline so much as a moving around and an occluding. And, you know, this is, you know, you said we're getting away from the book, but in a way, this is the kind of stuff I wanted the book to point outward toward. And, you know, part of why I like your book, the 10 Strikes book, is you are similarly saying, like, let's think about the strike and let's think about labor history, not in a kind of pigeonhole small topic, but like, this is, you know, let's get into fundamentals and think outward. After you finish the book, we're going to look at the world differently. It was kind of the ambitious. So, you know, either people think about injury or just, you know, these are kind of, I think, fundamental issues of class and dignity that are present all over, you know, American life, not only, and globally, as you're suggesting, you know, and not only with regard to injury.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, speaking of dignity, I mean, one of the things that I think that you do really well in here is give name to the people who have died. And you have this, you know, you do this through the book, but you know, I may point out just a couple of kind of examples. I mean, one is you make this choice to have this interlude where you list the names of the 200 odd or more people who die in the Cherry Mine fire. And which is a fire in Pennsylvania, I think in 1909, I believe.
Yeah, it's Illinois, but yeah.
Illinois. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. You know, but one of the many just horrible coal mine accidents of this era. And to me, that's very powerful. And I'm wondering, when you decided to just list their names and encourage us to think about it, or I believe you even say, or write the book, to say the names out loud, what is it that you're trying to accomplish here? What are you trying to get the reader to get to?
That's a very fair question, and I'm not sure I can give a satisfactory answer. I can say a lot of what I did in the book was very gut level. This stuff is awful, and it should kind of blow people's minds, and it should be hard to sit with. You know, it should be hard to look at. And so what I wanted throughout the book was to make, and I was aware of a danger, because, again, I talk about Marx, I talk about Walter Benjamin, I talk about Foucault, like there's theory stuff in there. And I talk about like very particular aspects of how insurance is funded. Like there's a lot of abstractions. It's really easy for people to get lost. And I wanted the book to kind of keep coming back to, like, you know, imagine being in the presence of, you're seeing your coworker be trapped in a machine screaming and smelling their skin burning and you can't get them out of the machine, or imagine that being you and that's happening to you. And like there was just a story, this is maybe 2 years ago, at an auto plant in Alabama that's heavily robotized, and like the exact same kinds of stuff I talk about happening in 1905 in industrial laundries happened to a guy, and he was in the machine for an hour. I found people who were trapped for 15 minutes. So I wanted the book to like kind of really like pause and make people kind of stare at that. And it, and not in a kind of voyeuristic way, but to be like, you know, this is the reality here. And anytime that I felt like it wasn't doing that, I kind of got uneasy. And so that interlude came in the middle where I was like, you know, chapter 1, 2, and 3 are the coming of workers' comp. And each chapter kind of looks at one institution. And the chapter largely sits over the shoulder of the institution with kind of periodical editorial asides from myself. And I think that worked. But the danger of sitting over the shoulder of the institution is that it's easy to only see what the institution sees. And so what I wanted the interlude in the middle was to kind of be this break that's like, again, calling us back to the awful harms. And I had a couple different thoughts on how to do it, and I didn't know how to make it work. And that was a kind of last minute and fairly intuitive decision. And I was really worried that it was bad or that it didn't make sense. And the book had been out for a few months before people started telling me. I've heard that from a couple of people that they find it very effective. I'm glad that you did too. Because that was something this is the only book I've written. And so, you know, I'm a novice writer and didn't know if it worked or not, but it felt really important to try. And that was kind of my spirit overall with the whole book, was being like, I don't think I'm important at all, but I think the stuff I'm talking about is really important. And it felt like this kind of duty to have this level of due diligence to like try my best to convey this stuff. And that was the effort. And you know, in that bit you're talking about specifically, if people haven't read the book, I kind of break the fourth wall and I'm like, hey reader, I'm going to give you the names of each of the 259 men who are listed as casualties. And this is going to look just like a wall of text and you're not going to want to read it. It's probably going to look boring. And that tells us something about how all this is presented, because I type those names manually out of a statistical table in a report, and it's boring visually to look at. But that was kind of again, this point that I was talking about before of like, this is 259. I mean, well, there's lots of, so the children who are on the cover of my book were people who lost, they were related to minors. They were listed. The photo is listed in the Library of Congress as orphans. It's not clear that they're all actually the children of minors. They could have been siblings or whatever, but every one of those kids is related to a dead minor from the Cherry Fire. And so, you know, this is like many, many people's worst day of their lives. And it's presented in this just very dry kind of way. And so I kind of wanted the book to really pause there and be like, you know, think about how every one of these people, went through this, and you know, and every one of them had all of these, you know, human ties. It's not to say that they're angels, like, you know, I'm not saying that they're necessarily good husbands or good fathers. I'm not trying to romanticize them, but just trying to say, you know, every one of these losses is a huge loss. And so that's what that bit does in the middle. And I'm glad to hear that it worked. Cause like, I now think it worked, but it really, the book was out for about 6 months before I was like, sure that I hadn't made a mistake. Cause that did not feel like I was being a normal historian when I wrote it. And I was really scared, but that's something I try to do generally, is I'm not a confident writer. I'm a fearful writer, but I try to be brave and just be like, well, hopefully it works. But I think when we write about deep stuff, you know, it's hard to feel adequate to the topic.
I've always felt that not being a normal historian is probably the best move you can make. But
that's kind of,
I also think this gets back to some of the things you're talking about earlier, which is that when we talk about employment, the economy, the labor market, it tends to be very abstract, you know. And even when we talk about things like workplace death, I mean, it doesn't get talked about very often, for one thing. I mean, it only takes something like the West Texas explosion back in, you know, 10 years ago or so, for this stuff to get into the news. And so it's quite rare that we hear about it at all. And I think that it really, but even outside of workplace death, the sort of dehumanized, number-oriented, economist-driven way of talking about the economy is actually kind of detrimental, and really tampens down, you know, activism around it, because, you know, they may say, well, it's like the talks about, you know, unemployment's like 5.5% or something, you know, employers are happy. And it's like, but that's one out of every 20 worker people who aren't making any money. And we all know how crappy unemployment is.
Well, that's the thing, is we don't all know, like all of us know, but not all of them know. I mean, and that's like the kind of what I think what ends up happening is like, we get encouraged to think in ways that is really the people who, give us orders, like we get encouraged to think about ourselves in the way that they think about us, you know? And I think that's really hard. And I think, you know, this is, I'm not a good enough labor historian to know this, but I would, you know, I think probably at the robust, I'm a historian of like terrible things that happened to the working class. I want to be a better labor historian about the labor movement and what workers do for themselves. You know, I care about that, but I don't know that stuff as well. But I think, you know, in conditions where we had a more robust labor movement, there would be a more robust kind of our side story about our about our side. And I think right now we have a fairly robust their side story about our side. And part of the, you know, I think what a lot of us who are doing the kind of labor history that I'm doing is kind of like critical stories of their side story, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it does. And you know, one thing we haven't really talked about yet, I we have time, I don't want to keep you too long here, but a couple more questions. And I think one of the things that we haven't really done is get into the details of your chapter. So I just want to bring up one chapter to give our listeners a sense of what they'd be reading. And that is this chapter about people who are already partially disabled getting hurt again and becoming fully disabled, which is a real, and then how the system deals with this, which is really disturbing, right? Because you know, you have these stories in there about this worker was blinded by this one thing, and then 8 years later, they had this other accident, and now they're blind in the other eye. It's so terrible. Could you just talk a little bit about that chapter, and it's just as a kind of a way to get into the larger arguments of the book?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So this was also one of the things that was really transformative for me intellectually. So as I said, I started off writing about these women industrial workers. And I would hear these stories where a person gets hurt and they're like, well, you know, I'm hurt now, I'll never work again. And I was like, yeah, you're disabled, you'll never work again. Because that's intuitive in the 2000s, right? But then I found evidence where actually people were disabled and still employed. And so that the conceptual link that we have now where like disability means employability, that's not a natural link, that's a historical link, which like for historians, that's like our basic move. This thing you take for granted, in fact, has a history, right? But I lived through that experience of like learning that, of being like, wait a minute, in fact, to be disabled has widely variable social ramifications that are historically determined. It's not just a fact of someone's body. And so that for me was a huge surprise and was something that I also tried to lean hard into in the book then, because I learned so much from writing that, from reading about it. And so what happens is in chapter four, so the first half of the book is the coming of workers' comp. And then the second half of the book is workers' comp in its early days in the aftermath, and really focuses on the effects of workers' comp on disabled people. And so in chapter four, I talk about workers who have like a physical impairment, like only one working eye or only one working hand or, you know, one leg and so on, or you know, missing several fingers. And these are people who at one point in time are fully acceptable hires. Now there's some evidence of wage discrimination, like, oh, you have one hand, you're worth half as much, so you get paid half as much. There's some evidence of that. And there's definitely legal approval of it. I found some court cases that talk about it. But at one point, I tried to prove this with census data, and I just got nowhere because disabled people were just not notable. Like, I don't know how you would find how many blue-eyed people there are in employment, because who cares about having blue eyes? It's like not relevant. Similarly, having physical impairments was largely institutionally irrelevant, and so no one seemed to be tracking it. Now, there were people who were so physically impaired that they were not employed. And there's some evidence on that. They use the ugly word cripple. There's talk about in the language of the day, there's how to care for quote unquote cripples. But even people who are studying that are repeatedly surprised. There's some early social work surveys at the actual labor market participation of so-called cripples is much higher than they expected. So we have an economy where, in fact, having physical impairment does not dictate unemployability. And it makes a certain kind of sense. If all the costs of injury are offloaded on the working class, there's no reason not to hire someone who's going to get who's already hurt. And if work is really, really dangerous, and so if you're a brakeman or you're a machinist for 20 or 30 years, you're going to lose some fingers very likely over time. And so if you've been a brakeman for 25 years and you've only got seven fingers, like that's awful and is a mark of how dangerous work is. But in a way, that's qualifying, where you're like, yeah, I've been around the block, I'm a really good brakeman, I've lost 2-3 fingers. And what happens with workers' comp is, so workers' comp comes in and you have work, really dangerous workplaces, plus the widespread presence of physically impaired people. And I always use the example of a glass bottle factory. So let's say you and I work in a glass bottle factory and I have only one working eye and you have 2 working eyes. And a glass bottle explodes and we both lose one eye. Well, you and I have both lost one eye in terms of quantity of body part. And at first, there are legal decisions that say we should be paid the same because we've lost the same quantity of body parts. But I'm blinded. your loss of one eye, because of the way binocular vision works, you go from 100% sight to about 65% sight. I go from about 65% sight to 0% sight through the blinding. And so then there's a series of lawsuits over these extra capacity losses that say, and workers win, and where it says the one-eyed guy is paid for the full blinding, not for the loss of the eye. And that's good for those individuals, but what it does is it raises the costs to employers of injuries to people who are already physically impaired. And really rapidly, employers are like, well, in that case, if it costs us extra money to hire the seven-fingered brakeman, it costs us extra money to hire the one-eyed guy in our glass bottle factory, why would we employ them? We're done. And that the second half of the book is sort of working out various forces that create that. That I think that makes sense to us intuitively based on incentives, but I don't want to, I think for as historians, we shouldn't just assume that what the market incentivizes will happen. So I wanted to actually investigate. And I found there's some policies that intensified it. And then the final chapter of the book is about industrial physicians who seem to be good-hearted people who set out to make a difference and improve occupational safety and health. And a lot of them end up being the frontline implementers of processes of discrimination to root out people who are now too expensive to hire. So yeah, that's the kind of the second half, and you know, and trying to say, in addition to, you know, injury is really important and it needs to be taken seriously, efforts to mitigate tend to fall unevenly, and the costs tend to get shifted downward onto especially vulnerable parts of the working class. And so I think that's also something that we need to be really conscious of.
So one last question, and I know, you know, we historians sometimes aren't super comfortable talking about the present, but you know, earlier in the podcast, you mentioned COVID, and yeah. You know, one of the things that we're seeing, you know, with say with the Starbucks organizing campaign is that a lot of this discontent came around unsafe COVID policies. And so, you know, thinking about what your book teaches us here for the 21st century and some of the issues we're having with a new form of unsafe workplaces, what are some things that say when you're teaching, either that your book imparts or when you're teaching these issues, that you try to get across to students about thinking about workplace safety in the contemporary workplace?
That's great. So the way I think about this is that harms, whether or not a harm is an injustice and whether or not a harm is like relevant to institutions is fundamentally a political question. And so this stuff matters when workers make it matter politically. And so we've seen in the COVID pandemic, lots of efforts to just sort of make the harms irrelevant politically and to shift the costs downward. So what the harms are and where the harms fall from our side is a deeply political issue. And from their side, you know, the government and employers, they want to say this is not a political issue. It's out of our hands. And also like the harm will lie where it falls. And they try really hard to make sure it falls really far down the food chain. And so I think like that's something that, you know, part of what these, you know, the Starbucks and like the Amazon labor union and, you know, other kind of, you know, what we're seeing lately, which, you know, hopefully heralds a wave of unionization. We'll see. You know, that part of what that's doing is politicizing things that we're encouraged to take as given and as non-political. And I think that's also something people should be really aware of, is that the ethical lives of institutions, the political lives of institutions will lean toward treating these harms as given and saying, just shut up and take it. It's nobody's fault. And hey, nothing personal, but it will fall on you. And that, you know, if we're relying on the humanity of powerful people to mean that they're just going to step in and do what's right by people, we're going to be waiting a really long time. And I think we're seeing that. I mean, this has been hard, not that I'm the main victim of the pandemic, but like I finished the book in late 2019 and then turned it in and was like going to move on and think about other stuff. And then like the pandemic happened, and it was in a way like this Kafka scenario of like, I fell asleep and woke up inside my book. Like these patterns that I were like, yeah, this 100 years ago, and probably they're relevant to the present. I don't know. Now I feel like it's like every day in the news, these patterns are playing out. And again, not that I'm the victim of the pandemic, but I think that it's a lot of the patterns I talk about in the book really writ large in hard ways.
Well, that's a great way to end this podcast. And I want to let readers know again that we've been talking to Nate Holdren of Drake University about his prize-winning 2020 book, Injury Impoverished, workplace accidents, capitalism, and law in the progressive era. Nate, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
We'll be back soon with another edition of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of the Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of the Paranoid Style's catalog anywhere you can find quality music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through the PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again,